David Shapiro is an American poet, literary critic, and art historian. He is perhaps best described as the quintessential Renaissance man. His work is articulate, engaging, intellectual, serious, and always tinged with his charming humor. In addition, he is also something of an accomplished violin player. David, welcome to the show.
I was going to read you a poem about a violin and then maybe even play you.
That would be awesome.
Oh, that would be awesome. That would be awesome. You know, there will be a point at the end of the interview where we always ask, if we're interviewing a poet, we ask them to read a poem. And at that point, you can...
Usually we ask for the ukulele, but the violin will work in this case.
I can say, oh, this is 1717, the good violin. I wept when my father finally bought it for me. He wouldn't buy me something by this guy, Jasper Johns, whom I had met. I was 15, and I told my father to buy Jasper's work, and he said, why should I listen to a 15-year-old? Now I said to Jasper, it's my favorite thing, and he sent me an etching the other day, and I said, I don't have to become rich. The only thing you can do when you're rich is to buy a Jasper Johns. There's nothing else you can do with your money. But this is to say, I did have a great year in 1962 where I met Frank O'Hara, who wrote to me a wonderful thing about critics. He said, isn't it true that most critics just prefer another poem? He also said, I know it was hard for you to send me your poems. I hadn't known it was difficult. But once he said it, I thought, oh, he's so sweet. It's so difficult to send your poems to someone.
Were you in New York at the same time he was? I know you went to Columbia and you were there as a...
I had gone to a writer's conference that I shouldn't have gone to, where people were teasing me a lot at 15. I had been publishing a lot, though Kenneth Koch, who was teaching, said, I love your poems. Why do you publish in such terrible magazines? I was only publishing in the magazines that I'd heard of, the Antioch Review, the Minnesota Review, and he thought that was very academic. But he was very sweet, and he said, I see we both love Rilke. We love to walk out of our body. And I hadn't really known that that was what I had gotten from Rilke. And then Kenneth said, called one poem Splendid, which I loved. He introduced me to some other poets, and one of them was Allen Ginsberg was there, Frank O'Hara was there. And so by 15, I had met really standards of excellence, you might say, you know, the energy of these great poets. And I was a bit of a mascot. Frank O'Hara said, every year we kill a young poet. We call it
That's hilarious.
Top game.
Well, I'm really enjoying your book of selected poems, and I'm amazed at January. I mean, you know, I like all the sections, but January is just an amazing poetry. And you did that when you were 18. That was published when you were 18?
It was really done when I was about 12 to 13 years old in love with blonde hair. I was in love with someone's blonde hair in the Allstate Orchestra. So you better believe, I remember somebody saying that it was filled with desire. And of course it was. But yeah, I was very young because I had trained as a violinist very young, like from age 3. They put a violin in my crib. So in the other crib, my father was screaming Milton. Everything was done by heart. He would say, who durst defy the omnipotent to arms? Exclaiming. And then I started to imitate every poet that was brought to me. I learned The Wasteland, and a psychoanalyst said I couldn't be demented if I still knew The Wasteland by heart.
And could you imitate T.S. Eliot?
Fairly well, but also Ezra Pound is funnier. Years out of key with his time, he strove to resuscitate the dead art of poetry. Wrong from the start, factitious bait. And Eliot, I happen to have studied The Wasteland in a Cadman recording with Robert Speight, the actor, so I know it as, but it's very close to Eliot. April is the cruelest month. Reading lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. And so my mother said, "Do you understand that?" I was about 10. And I said, "I do." And she said, you don't even know the German. But I knew how to recite it. And it took me years before I understood it. I simply loved it. I'm always amazed when people don't love T.S. Eliot. Kenneth was one of them. Kenneth Koch loved proof rock, but thought the rest was a sort of philosophical junkyard. John Ashbery once said of Montale, "Isn't he the Italian T.S. Eliot?" And I said, "Well, that wouldn't be too bad, would it?"
You know, I love Eliot as well. Not so much The Wasteland as some of his other works. I really love Ash Wednesday a great deal.
I'm glad you didn't say Cats.
No.
I was amazed that his wife has been very tough about, publishers were tough about not mentioning, for example, something painterly and his work, because Mr. Eliot didn't want his work to be illustrated. But I said, if you couldn't mention, let's say, Beckett, a painting, something else, you would annihilate 20th century criticism as I know it. But at any rate, Eliot's Confessions of Failure get to me in the four quartets.
Yes.
It's not that one loves everything, but when he really says that he has wasted 20 years of his life, that I understand. In another context, presumably he was asked whether it was all worth it, and he said, "I don't think so."
Oh, that's funny.
I look at my book. This is only a 20th of what I've scribbled on paper. Now, of course, with typewriters and this terrible computer that I'm not good at, someone said the new thing is the dictaphone. Do any of you know whether it works? Because the last dictaphone that I tried years ago sounded like a schizophrenic out of Dallas's darker moments.
Well, it does work, but the problem is you have to speak the punctuation, and every time you want a new line, you have to say "new line," which can seriously interrupt the rhythm.
Yes, that's for our book called New Lines.
Yeah. I've started again to write my poems by hand.
It makes writing by hand very beautiful because there is a kind of intimacy that I've always felt. There are many poems I typed since age 5. I was a medical secretary because my father loved saving some money, so I knew things like diagnosis, falling in a pot of lye, prognosis, poor, ability, 90%. I was always typing, and I felt bad recently when, because of a tremor, people thought that I was a very bad speller. My brother-in-law said, "How can a former Columbia professor be misspelling?" But it happened.
You know, we had Mark Strand on the show, and he says that the reason why he writes a poem longhand is because if he did it on a computer or a typewriter, it looks finished before it's finished.
Finished before finished is a very good title.
You're always thinking of titles.
When abandons things not finished, and the Jewish proverb is, it is safe to say that you will not finish the task, but it is not yours to abandon it. That's a famous rabbi.
Oh, I love that.
I know poets who are always sending me the revisions that they've made. One has gone up to 50 revisions, always telling me it's the last and the best. You have to watch out because now I've seen The Bag in New York, I Too Like It, a revision of Marianne Moore, but by someone else. But Marianne Moore and others sometimes made the worst revisions. And
I agree.
There are some terrible revisions by Wordsworth of himself and Whitman of himself. And you know that one word, I once said that Frank O'Hara revised and Larry Rivers said, "Well, he only changed a word here or there." And I said, "Larry, that's what we call writing."
You know, do you think Emily Dickinson revised?
Well, in one sense, she was constantly changing that musical space by her dashes and discontinuities. I think that she was more or less in a kind of mania. I happened to love and then had a dream about the poem, "The Heart Asks Pleasure First," and then I said, "And then for seconds." But her are easy to memorize. I've memorized thousands of them. It's like memorizing haiku. It's hard to believe that anything is better. I usually think that the pillars of the 19th century are really Whitman and Dickinson.
Oh, I agree.
And Dickinson didn't even love Whitman, which is perfect, of course.
Yes, of course it is. Let me ask you something about your interest in art, David. I have a particular interest in art as well. And I have a good friend of mine who's a poet, W.S. DePiro. He's also a very fine art critic.
Oh, right.
Yes. And I'd like to
his work, and I know a painter who loves him, Paul Retzica.
Yeah, he's a wonderful poet and has a very, very keen eye for art, and he's very...
Let me tell you what happened with me. I was very lucky, though I never thought of it as luck, that my father had been bored during the Second World War by being stationed with nothing to do. He was a doctor. And someone was there from the French embassy, Bly, a neoclassicist, who happened to have worked with Rodin. And he gave my father a lump of clay, and my father did an amazing first sculpture. And I grew up with this father who believed in Bach and Beethoven, so he was mostly thinking about music all the time, not dermatology. He said he was a failure in dermatology. He was really, I've been too judgmental, says Jasper, so I won't judge him, and I actually like his work. But I grew up around kilns and heat and sculpture. So a tremendous amount of my life was feeling that I couldn't do things because my father would say to me, you don't have the occipital orb first. You must have the occipital orb. He had the language of medicine when he worked, and he could make a sculpture so quickly. So I was always surrounded by painters and others. It was a terrible moment when I saw that my father was showing a painting of mine, terrible painting, to Frank O'Hara and Larry Rivers. It was coming out of the back of a car. I had just given it was bad enough that I had given a poetry reading. But I thought, oh, my God. But they were very sweet. I was young enough. Frank O'Hara said to me, what did you like in MoMA one day? And I said, the Chelichev. And he said, why? And I knew something was wrong. I said, well, it's very bright in its colors. I was 15. And Frank said, you should have seen it before the fire. I never cared for the Chelichev again.
Do you have a favorite artist or a favorite painting?
My favorite artist is Giorgione. Giorgione said, John Ashbery, well, that's not very original. I said, well, do you want to know the truth or do you want the originality? John is so good on liking very eccentric Parmigianinos before anyone else does. But I must say that for different reasons, I find the melancholy of Jasper is the closest to what I want in poetry. And so just as Meyer Shapiro is my mentor, was my mentor for years and years, and he would still be my mentor, and his taste for Cézanne became my god, and I often say, and I'm monotheistic, but with Meyer, it's the ability to love so many different things. I think that my poetry is still that of a not-so-divine amateur, but I can't live without that ideal of the Chinese, you know, the perfections, painting, poetry, calligraphy. When I went to China, they would splash some ink and say, this is like your Jackson Pollock.
You know, as I read your poems, I wonder sometimes if you have ever use literal dreams, the dreams that you have, to enter the poetic landscape.
For years, I didn't want to say that was true. But at 15, I had the phrase, the Cuban car door is smashed to bits. Then I started to learn how to remember my poems. And it sounds very Californian, so I don't talk about it. Almost a quarter of my poems. Fairfield Porter once said to me, how did you write this poem, Devil's Trill Sonata? And I said, well, maybe I shouldn't tell you, but a lot of it inspired by music, of course, but a lot of it is inspired by my dreams, which I can remember. And he said, oh, that accounts for its dreamy quality. And for years, I took that as a rebuke. I don't think Fairfield was rebuking me. We did a lot of work together. He taught me. I said to him, I wanted to learn how to foreshorten. And he said, well, I'll teach you tonight. I said, tonight? You'll teach me foreshortening, the secrets of foreshortening tonight? He said, yes. At night, he set me up, and he said, draw what you see. And I said, is that all? He said, draw what you see. But I've learned a lot from all of the painters of generations. But my gods, of course, were de Kooning. I met my wife talking about de Kooning. She dared to put down de Kooning, and I thought, who is this girl? What character does she have? How does she have the strength to talk against de Kooning? She says she didn't. She was simply mentioning another painter that I really didn't know, Pousset Dar, who I think of as having brought us together. But my wife took me to a Meyer Shapiro class, and this was when we were about 18, 19, and I said to her, it's a cadenza of bliss. It's a golden cadenza. And my wife turned to me and said, like any art historian, she was a great art historian, she said, what's more, it's all true. One slip and he's finished.
We're talking to David Shapiro, whose book just came out, Selected Poems, which is poems all the way from the time you were 18 to your, I guess, your last book?
Really, from 13 and 12.
13 and 12.
I'm embarrassed to put it down, but let's say there are many poems that were written when I was so young that I should be ashamed of putting them in. But it was part of me. When John Ashbery met me, he said, oh, here's the greatest 13-year-old poet. And I was so angry because I was I was 15. And I didn't realize that to him, 13 to 15 didn't matter that much. Now when I meet 16-year-old poets, I think that they should be fairly well developed. It's true for the violin that one doesn't say Menuhin. One says early Menuhin, and Menuhin was quite good. But for me to mention him is a big mistake, because at a certain moment, Menuhin, my family said, we're not bad. We don't accompany you to your honeymoon like Menuhin's family. And I thought, since I was 10 when they said this, what's so bad that it's about having your mommy come to your honeymoon? But you know, the idea of the idiot savant is one thing, but I think that what Kenneth liked, he said, was, as with Rimbaud, our favorite poet, one likes the idea of learning about useful experience, which is sometimes sort of finished up for us. We have forgotten it. We've forgotten how to be a child. So for me, it was wonderful to teach my son poetry and teach him what I called the secrets of poetry, which he loved. The secrets of poetry, sworn secrets of poetry, are such things as Chekhov's use of humor and tragedy together. These are the great secrets of poetry, and using hard words and easy words together. The secrets are, of course, not secrets, but I did influence, there's a novelist, Siri, who is my student, Siri Hustvedt, and she was blocked, she said to me one day. She couldn't write poems. She was imitating some New York school poets very well, but I said to her, why don't you just pretend to be a surrealist and do nothing revision prone, just write for about a day or two. She did, and she didn't look back. She's written about six novels that she accredits from Professor X. I am Professor X. But it's true that I do a lot of, I've learned a lot from dreams, the discontinuity of dreams, but I've also learned from the realists of my age, like Fairfield. He was enamored of light. And one of his last days, he said to me that he wanted to take a walk around the beach, and I said, fine. And we started very early, and he talked about light and how difficult it was to get flesh and light together. And then he said something about that we were talking about John Ashbery and whether he had a religious streak in him, which of course he does. And Fairfield said something like, that's it. It's not behind everything. It is everything. He wanted every sermon to end with these words, he said, pay attention. Pay attention to ultimate reality. And he said that John had then said, what does ultimate mean, Fairfield? But then I said, but he does have he is religious, just in his own way. And it's true that John Ashbery, I think, was a little embarrassed that I was using the word God in my early poems. My son has a poem where he was angry with me, and he said, are you the boss of God? Hey, let's write that. You're the boss of God. Nobody's the boss of God. I said, let's go upstairs and write this down. He went upstairs with me and he said, nobody is the boss of God. Not me, not you. Are the angels the boss of God? Are you more famous than angels? I didn't really know what famous meant. And then he said, God is the boss of himself, orders himself to do what he wants. I am the boss of this poem. I wrote it. I was about to title it. He said he was going to title it. So it's titled The Boss Poem. But someone said, and I think it's true, that David Shapiro is not teaching the kids so much as he's learning from them what he doesn't have. And I think I started early on the violin, as one always does on the violin. You're in old age homes by 10 as a violinist. But as a poet, very often poetry is a very good place for wisdom. And I hope that I've gotten wise. Someone said, you're either very embittered or wise. And a monsignor of the church said to me, I must be wise because I'm not bitter.
Well, you know, reading your book, one of the things that I'm learning, and I'm not a poet, I'm a fiction writer, but one of the things I'm learning is the similarities between dream logic and poetic logic.
Yes, it got me into a lot of trouble. Son was brought into class. He was doing crazy metaphors and metonymies. And I told the teacher, well, that's what I teach him. You know, I'm a poet. And she said, naughty, 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 inappropriate. And also somebody said to be or not to be, and my son finished the monologue. And they also thought that that was inappropriate. And I said, I was taught poetry in a variety of ways, like the Jabberwocky. It's hard to know what the Jabberwocky is. But, you know, speaking of fiction, someone was telling me to write a memoir the other day. And I like what Paul Goodman at some moment said. It looks as if poets are lying all the time, as Nietzsche said. Uh-huh. But actually, he said, I think this is so brilliant. He said, actually, poets find it very hard to lie at all. And our difficulty with fiction is it's too close to us. And I've found over the years that there's a poet who seems so much a lying, whimsical New York School poet that I once said, have you ever used a lie detector test while you write poetry? And I think some of the great poets, you feel that they have, in a sense, you know, you don't think of late Stevens as being fictional. When Akhmatova was asked the famous question, can you write this to women who were being tortured and their children gone? And Akhmatova said, yes, I can. And so it wasn't that she had to write a fiction about oppression. She had to be very careful about it. Matter of fact, she gets so careful that she didn't like any of her translators because they didn't follow her rhyme schemes. All of it, all of the insides of poetry are true. I think at any rate, that's why Plato was forced to get rid of his poems by Socrates. I think Socrates, who I've written about in a cantata with a great Arab composer, Socrates was a poet. He was anguished, I think, at what might happen if philosophy became too lyrical. I once had a teacher in Columbia who said, if you raise the specter of the lyrical Plato again in this class, Mr. Shapiro, I will have to fuck you or get rid of you.
Do you think that art is doing the same thing as poetry?
Yes, it's my determined view on this show where we don't have hundreds of years to elaborate, but it's my determined view that poetry is architecture, architecture is poetry, and the great architect John Haydock believed this with me, so he made the crazy strategy of bringing me to teach architects, and our idea was architecture would not be greed, zoning laws, etc., but it would be a place where architects could think about how to make architecture in the condition of cubism, how to make architecture in the condition of Vasily Kandinsky. And there's no doubt that the great schools, like the Black Mountain School, but one thinks primarily of my old friend John Cage, he was told that he had to concentrate on one thing, and it was very hard to do anything about one thing except music. But we just saw his watercolors, and they're heartbreaking. They're so beautiful. And his ideal brushes, which he made for himself out of feathers. And John is an example of a man who said that he believed that one should dedicate oneself to one thing. But on the other hand, he dedicated himself to everything, to ballet, to dance. So my preference in thinking about things is like Jakobson's sense. I had met him. Jakobson believed that everything was structure, and that was a very beautiful insight. It can become academic, And certainly some people can make terrible paintings. I'm one of them.
My
wife, when she met me, would say of a red nude that I had done, "Why don't you reconsider the top corner?" I reconsidered it. She then said, "Why don't you reconsider the other half of it?" Finally, I said, "You don't like this painting." And she didn't. And after about 40 years, I threw it out. I decided she was right, and I got rid of it. But you have to be very careful. A madman said to me, "If you can, save everything. It'll be useful for you in a Jungian way." I didn't know Jung. I was 10. So I'm useful for libraries now because I've saved, not that I've given them away, but I've saved thousands of letters that in those days were handwritten by Marion Moore or handwritten by Frank O'Hara.
Isn't it too bad that doesn't happen anymore? I have several letters from my mentor, Denise Levertov, and she always handwrote her letters, and I treasure them.
Yes, I wrote about Denise's poetry for some magazine. It's a pity that I was saying this to Robert Creeley, who came to Kenneth Koch's funeral. I said, "It's so marvelous that you've come here." And he said, "Well, you know, we knew each other." And I said, "But you know what I mean, Bob. No one can be worse than poets," said a sculptor to me. "Even sculptors are not as bad as poets." What he meant was this terrible sense that though we should all be doing the same thing, as it were, the difference is so hypostatized that you get the sense that we're all at war with each other. And I met once a poet, David Ignatow, and he said to me, "Of course, we don't agree on anything." And I said, "Well, we both like Shakespeare." And he said, "Oh, yes." I said, "No, but we also both like Dufu." He said, "You like Dufu?" I said, "Very much." And then I said, "I even know your poetry by heart." And I recited him because I used to memorize thousands and thousands of poems. And he was very struck by the fact that I knew his poetry by heart. As I was struck when Harold Bloom said that he knew a sonnet of mine by heart. I said, "I challenge you." And he recited it. And it was a pretty bad poem. So I was intrigued.
Who are some of your favorite contemporary American poets?
Keats. Someone said, I said, Richard Castellanos is a well-known avant-gardist. And I said, "Stevens is my favorite living poet." And he said, "He's dead." And I said, "Not for me." So for a long time, I would have answered that, Stevens. And there is an encyclopedia that has a chapter called "Our Dead Contemporaries." That's really terrible. But there is the sense in which if you play Schubert's Quintet in C, as I did at my mother's own funeral, you don't get a sense that it's aged or is a certain number of years. I mean, it's true teaching. I teach that Picasso was born in 1881 and died in 1973 or whatever. And it is important sometimes, as I tell my kids, to know when Les Demoiselles d'Avignon was done, because you can be dazzled by the relationships between Cubist works. But for me, a lot of the great masters are gone. So today, for example, I said to someone, I would still be shocked if Godard walked through my door. But I've gotten to the point where I like what Godard said about himself. Someone said, "Your work is often called too difficult." And he said, "Yes. Yes, but what about your hamburgers?" "Your hamburgers are not so good." Ben said in a poem or place, he said, "I am a man, only a man. I am no better than other men, and no man is better than me." I like the idea of a democracy in one sense. It's great to know how to praise one's contemporaries. And then Frank O'Hara said, "They are also useful thorns in one's side." But I'm philosophically a pluralist. I love many different kinds of paintings, both realistic and abstract. I've been trained to be a pluralist by a great pluralist, Meyer Shapiro. I asked Bill de Kooning once, "Is it true, the story that Meyer Shapiro saved your woman number one, that my teacher Meyer came over and talked about?" He said, "Yes, tell him to come again. That man tells you that what you do, you should be doing, not like the other guys who tell you not to do what you're doing. Tell him to come again. Tell him to come again." We need very often positive criticism. I can be very tough on myself, and I know the great revisions that that made things so amazing. But still in all, if you ask me who I learned from the most, it's probably Proust and Kafka. Proust on the side of the starless chaos of the social, and Kafka on the starless side of the interior. I mean, if God doesn't include Kafka and Proust, then I'm not in the religion.
We're talking to David Shapiro, art critic and poet, whose new selected poems just recently came out. Can I ask you, is the brushstroke to a painting the same as a line to a poem?
I often think, what are those relationships? For example, Meyer Shapiro liked the idea that the I, the he, the you, are all these different positions, that when Moses has his hands lifted, he wrote a book about frontality. On the other hand, there's a great work by Barry, and it's a criticism of Jakobsen that we don't exactly know. While I like to say how influenced I am by the relationships, there is a great relationship between Merce Cunningham and John Cage in terms of the brushstrokes of their gestures. But it's not exactly true. We have to be careful that in comparing, we compare and contrast at the same time. So it's something that would take a long time, but I'm happy to say that after 20 to 40 years teaching architects, I know something about architecture through poetry. There's a group in Chile that teaches, like me, architecture through the great surrealists. And they're a very strange group, and there's a book about them that your audio ship would like. The book is called The Road That Is Not a Road. And it's people that, for example, Frank Gehry, we gave the first show to, my wife gave him a first show, and people couldn't stand his work at the beginning. They just couldn't stand it. He just thought that he was following a lot of the tendencies that he saw in painting. And so if you write a poem and what's in your mind is the greatness, the real gloire of de Kooning, you write a different kind of poem. And Lorca surely is better understood after reading Frank O'Hara on de Kooning, and it all should come together in a way that you feel in the greatest of Picasso and Matisse, that somehow their brushstrokes are indeed like the poets that they loved. It was always said of Picasso that he had a poet around him. I think a lot of what he liked was that the poets could formulate what he didn't really want to formulate. But I want to tell you one thing that I learned from William Rubin, the head of the Museum of Modern Art, was that he was with Picasso, and he said, "Picasso, is there always an object in your work?" And Picasso said, "It's more like perfume in front of you, in back of you, to the sides of you. It's the perfume of an object." Mm-hmm. That, I think, is why we love Reverdy and these poets who were creating the perfume of an object. He then went to the bathroom, and I said to Bill, "Does he often say things like that?" He said, "No, he usually talks about women and cigars." I give to our listening audience the idea of the fragrance of an object, and that puts perfumes of caves together with poetry. I love the new cave movie. The Shadows of Forgotten Caves is not the right title, but it's by Herzog, and you see what is possibly the beginning of art, something that is really taboo, but it's an amazing dream of 25,000 years ago of what kind of art there could be. There was already bone flutes and things. My son used to always ask me, what came first, sports or poetry?
I once heard you compare a line in poetry that hesitates and corrects itself, that says one thing and then goes, no, something else, to a brushstroke of Matisse.
I was lucky enough to know John Haydick, who was one of the great draftsmen, and he could make a line passionately hesitate. And Giacometti is another person who, someone said, trembles precisely. Mm-hmm. I think that I might have gotten it from Bill de Kooning, but I know that whenever I was over Elaine de Kooning, she would do something and say, "This is what Bill told me to do. This is what Bill told me to do." I said, "Are you going to write your memoirs?" And she said, "Yes, and the title will be Always in Love with Bill." But I know if you go to the Met, you'll see what Bill de Kooning saw every week when he studied the early Christian works that Meyer Shapiro told him to study. And Meyer used to say that who Leger and Mata had asked him, what do you do if there's only one day in New York? And he told them to go to the Morgan Library and look at the apocalypses there. And they had an influence on the flatness of painters are always learning, and sometimes they learn, as did Bryce Martin, from a poem. He loved the poems of Dufu, and my poems are often really given to me. I like that idea that they're given to you. They're not learned exactly. But it is true that I imitated every poet in the world before I could write my own poetry.
And that's not a bad way to learn. David, you've been a charming guest, and I'd ask you to now read your violin poem and play your violin for us. It would be a real pleasure.
Here's a little poem about a violin, but before I do it, I'll play you the violin that I'm talking about. Unfortunately, I'm out of shape, so I'm only going to play you a little bit that I played at my bar mitzvah. It's better when I was 13. Grungy version of something that teaches us again what you learn from my grandfather, the greatest Jewish singer. You can get him on the computer under Chagy, and he would go to the Apollo Theater with Achron, the composer of that piece, and they would learn. He said he learned from the Persian hour. He learned and he learned, and it was all this joy of different kinds of music. And now I'll read you a poem that was inspired, though someone said, I often say things, who cares what inspired it? But what inspired it was fairy tales of the Russian kind. The Russians often say it was and it was not. And so this is a poem, Falling Upwards. A certain violinist had a beautiful violin, but before he had time to play her long and listen to her tones as such, he was compelled to renounce music and sell her, and go on a far journey, and leave his violin in the hands of the violin case. What was there to do? It is said, you cannot live life in quarter tones. What was there to do? It is said, you cannot live your life in silence. What was there to do? It is said, you cannot live your life playing scales. What was there to do? It is said, you cannot live your life listening to the Americans. What was there to do? It is said, you cannot live your life in your room and not go out. What was there to do? It is said, music disobeys and reaches the prince's courtyard ever farther than smell and grits its notes like teeth and gives us food and drink and orders a fire to be lighted, famished silk to hang over it, and repetitions to be sharpened. What was there to do? It is said, it is the violinists who do not sleep. What was there to do? It is said, we think and don't think. We are asleep. What was there to do? It is said, music sinks into the mire, up to its neck, wants to crawl out but cannot. What was there to do? It is said, the violin was a swan, sees the boy, falling upwards to some height above the earth. That's the end of that poem, and I thank you.
Thank you for being on our show, David Shapiro. It's been a real pleasure.
As you leave, my mother would say it was too sad. I'll play you a little Bartok as background music. To
okay.
I have music from Bartok. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, David.
Thank you so much. It was great.
I long for El Pato.